This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, brand name basketball and the repo market made simple. Not in the same story, by the way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 9th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the not entirely idle speculation of what James Naismith would think of the sport that he invented, lo, these 128 years ago, and the global economic context in which it finds itself. We are, of course, a long way from the peach baskets that Naismith used as the original hoops, and the global economy is nothing like it was in 1891. But a quick glance at the news, sports or otherwise, reveals basketball as the pivot point of perhaps the biggest corporate story of this day. The National Basketball Association and the aftermath of a tweet from Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey last week supporting anti-government protests in Hong Kong. The response from Beijing has been swift and clear. An NBA fan event before a preseason game between the Brooklyn Nets and LA Lakers in Shanghai has been canceled. A public training session for the Nets also in Shanghai also called off. Corporate Chinese sponsorships with the NBA undone. Meanwhile, the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, says Morey has the right to exercise his freedom of expression. It is a big, big deal, this story, with peril aplenty. So we got Marketplace's Andy Euler on the line to hash things out with us. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Kai.
So look, this is kind of basic, but clearly it seems the basics have been lost in this. The NBA has been, for decades now, one of the most progressive of professional sports leagues. Do you suppose that somehow they didn't see something like this coming? And if they didn't see it, why didn't they see it?
Well, that's the thing. You're getting right to it, right? The difficulty here for the NBA is that it does want to be seen as a progressive league. It doesn't want to go off brand. But the NBA also has to be wary of its brand in China. If the brand is tarnished in the eyes of Chinese businesses, of consumers, that's going to prove difficult and costly for the NBA to remedy in China. This is something that every American sports league is going to take note of because they all see the money in China. They want to do business there. Right. And I even spoke with a sports marketing professor from China. He kept telling me that the everyday business of sport in China, it's market-based, right? It's similar to doing business in the U.S. We all know that. We've heard that 100 times. Then he said, just be sure not to get on the wrong side of the government because then the market gets thrown out the window.
Well, that's so interesting. So clearly the calculation that's happened here is that the Chinese government has decided it does not need the NBA's brand to do basketball in China, right? Because they're growing their own leagues and they can, in essence, do it themselves, no matter how popular Yao Ming and the Houston Rockets and all of those folks are over there.
But the NBA is the brand, right? Chinese basketball is NBA China, basically. When Yao Ming came onto the scene in 2002 – the popularity of basketball in China skyrocketed because you had a dude out there who looked like them. You had 200 million people watch that first game. It's going to be so difficult for the Chinese government if they just want to say, look, we got this. We're going to have basketball. Basketball is great here. We have all sorts of stars. It's going to be so difficult because the other thing is Americans who don't make it to the NBA go and play in China. And so there's so much sort of meshing there with the NBA in China that it's going to be so difficult for the Chinese to be able to do that.
Let us take this away from basketball for 2 seconds, because the NBA is certainly not the first company that has run into trouble in China. Just today, there was a controversy with Apple and one of its apps that lets people identify police in Hong Kong, and the Chinese government is displeased with that. There is wider risk. There is also wider acknowledgement of some of the challenges of doing business in China. Tipping point, do you think? I mean, you know, spitball that for me.
that's what I kept asking the smarter people that I am about this when you're talking about sort of Chinese relations and things like that. And it's funny because everybody that I spoke with says, you know what? These are hiccups, and businesses are going to have to do better at navigating business in China. Nobody is saying they're going to pull out of China. No business person thinks that because there's so much money there, they just don't see an American company just pulling out because of difficulties. So instead of let's get out of here, this is a tipping point, we don't want to deal with China anymore. It's figure out how to do business better there.
Andy Euler covers sports and a bunch of other stuff for us out of KUT in Austin, Texas. Andy, thanks a bunch. Appreciate it.
You got it, Kai.
Random observation, by the way, just on the whole market size dynamics of this thing. By most estimates, there are almost as many basketball fans in China, 300 million or so, as there are people in the United States, 330 million or so. So there is that. All right, we are going to leave sports behind for the moment and turn to the no less fascinating, to some of us anyway, subject of monetary policy. The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today. I will spare you all the Fed speak, save this tidbit. Markets, the minutes say, and here's the quote, "We're currently suggesting a greater provision of accommodation at coming meetings than they saw as appropriate," they being the Fed here, and accommodation being shorthand for lower interest rates. So what that actually means, that whole thing I just read, is that maybe markets and traders and investors and everybody else are banking too much on interest rate cuts the next time the Fed meets. Next Fed meeting, by the way, for the calendar types among you, the 29th and 30th of this month. So stay tuned. As we always say about the Fed, by the way. Down at the corner of Wall Street and Broad on this rainy day in Manhattan, sunshine. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The housing news of this Wednesday is of home values, how those values get figured out specifically. Federal banking regulators are putting a new rule into effect today that says certain home sales in the $400,000 range or below aren't going to have a traditional appraisal anymore. The old threshold, $250,000, was set back in 1994. So yes, this is partly an adjustment for inflation. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, it is also a recognition that once again, technology can do a lot of the work that people used to do.
The rule will apply to about 40% of home sales. It doesn't include loans backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for example. Loans that are exempt from an appraisal will still require an evaluation. What's the difference, you ask?
The valuation itself is data-driven. So no longer is there a human in that loop, at least in terms of the value.
Alex Villacorta is head of data and analytics at real estate tech company House Canary. He says humans aren't completely out of the loop. They still inspect the property and take pictures.
You know, to make sure the property's there, that it's in decent condition, and if it's not, highlighting whatever deficiencies may be there.
But instead of that human analyzing those photos and comparable sales to come up with a value, computer algorithms do it. That's pretty scary for the appraisal industry, which employed 80,000 people last year. Kelly Davids is senior vice president with the Appraisal Foundation, which sets the professional standards for the industry. She says algorithms work fine in places where the housing is fairly uniform.
But that doesn't happen in large swaths of America where there's nuances in the housing stock, where the data maybe isn't as current. So somebody who's really trained and ethical has to look at all of that and weed out the bad from the good.
But ethics have been a problem in the industry. Research from the Philadelphia Fed found that less than 10% of appraisals came in below the contract price. Ben Keyes is an associate professor of real estate at the Wharton School. He says appraisers may feel pressure to deliver numbers on the high side.
When we think of the robots taking over various sectors, there are certainly risks associated with that, but we have to keep in mind the risks that were in place when the market was run by humans.
For the foreseeable future, though, the humans and robots will have to get along. Measuring value still requires both. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We delve now into the minds of the driving force in this economy at this moment, you and a zillion people like you, consumers who are in the face of a manufacturing slowdown and global concerns and trade this and tariff that, somehow still floating this economy and keeping the expansion going. We do it, you and I and everyone, by spending money. And our willingness to spend is determined in very large part by how we feel. If we're feeling things are good, we shop. So, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went out to sample some feelings in Portland, Oregon.
Out by the Portland airport, there's a cluster of big box stores, Best Buy, Staples, Ross Dress for Less. I meet this shopper waiting right outside IKEA.
My name is Lori Holton. I'm 50 years old, and I used to be a substitute teacher, but we have grandkids now, so I'm a stay-at-home grandma.
Holton's husband's gone to get their van, packed full of new kids' furniture, from the busy parking lot.
That was my husband. Loop around again.
Holton's husband works for a steel fabricating company. A couple years ago, the Trump administration's steel tariffs were a problem for the business, but now
they've weathered that well and they're doing well.
Which means she feels like her family's doing well, too. Holton's like most consumers, a good economy means, first, a good job with reliable income. Still, she's cautious. Saving for retirement comes before shopping sprees.
If you spend big, can we manage to pay our house off and make our kids comfortable when we're gone?
The financial crisis and bad recession a decade ago weigh on her mind, even though no one in her family lost their job or home.
Do I believe it could happen again? Yes. I've watched the stock market rise and rise and rise, and the housing market, we could get that bubble again.
Inside IKEA, I find Anthony Caesar shopping for his 2-year-old son in the kids section. Caesar's 38. He works in a local metalworking shop. His wife Ashley's a stay-at-home mom. I ask how the economy's treating them.
I mean, it could be treating us better, that's for sure.
Caesar makes $18 an hour. The couple recently bought their first home on the outskirts of Portland.
To the overall economy, we've been fortunate. We really appreciate that, but we just paycheck to paycheck trying to make ends meet. You know, if something were to happen to me right now, like, I don't have any health insurance. A couple of missed mortgage payments and we could be out on the street with nothing.
Feeling okay about the economy right now, but not trusting it to last, that seems common. It's how 59-year-old Patty Stewart feels. She's waiting in the long IKEA checkout line to buy fixture samples for her brother's home renovation project here in Portland. She's visiting from Petoskey, Michigan, where she restores antique furniture, like dining room sets.
My business is absolutely booming. It's a lost art, and I'm totally swamped.
Stewart feels like she's doing fine right now. Plenty of work, enough income and savings to make her feel secure in her personal economic situation. But the national economy?
Maybe okay now, but I don't have a whole lot of faith that it can continue, and that's really scary.
It's good to have a steady job or a thriving business, own a home, save a bit for retirement, and be able to afford some shopping at a giant Swedish furniture store. That feels like a good economy. But as for all that inspiring belief in a good economic future, not so much. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have had to take children and keep them in a hotel or motel somewhere close.
The opioid crisis and its youngest victims straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 181 points today, 0.7%, 26,346. The NASDAQ up 79 points, 1%, 79.03 there. The S&P 500 up 26.9%, 29.19 on that index. Apple polished up 1.1% today. An analyst raised his price target for the stock, citing strong sales of the iPhone 11. Microsoft firmed up 1.8%. Cybersecurity firm FireEye up 4.9% today. Denim clothing company Levi Strauss dropped 7.4% today. The firm posted better than expected revenues, but wholesale in the Americas apparently not so good. Kontoor, which owns Wrangler and Lee brands, was unchanged. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Jay Powell gave a speech in Denver yesterday, and as happens basically all the time, the Fed chair's words were closely parsed. In particular, what he said about the Federal Reserve Bank of New York putting billions of dollars into something called the repo market. Repo is, well, it's sort of a wonky, but a critical part of the financial system, essential for keeping money moving in this economy. And the reason we bring it up is that until last month, the New York Fed hadn't really intervened in the repo market in a big way since the financial crisis. That is the cue for this next installment of our series, Kai Explains, where we take things really slow to figure out what's really going on.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
First of all, the basics.
The repo market is the foundation of the financial markets. It's really the plumbing of the system that underlies movements of cash and collateral.
Beth Hammack is now the global treasurer of Goldman Sachs.
I used to be the head of our repo trading desk.
Repo trades are a regular part of doing business for Goldman Sachs and all the rest. Short-term loans used to pay for daily operations. More than $1 trillion moves through the repo market every day, and part of the New York's Fed job is keeping an eye on things, making sure all that money keeps moving like it's supposed to. In a repo trade, one financial institution in need of quick cash essentially sells something to another institution, treasury bonds most often, with the promise that they will repurchase those treasuries the next day. Repurchase, repo, get it?
Think about it as if you were going bowling.
Okay.
You'd walk up to the counter and you're wearing your fancy shoes. You need to deposit your shoes at that counter and they'll give you bowling shoes that you can borrow. You pay a small fee to do that, but they have your shoes as collateral against the bowling shoes they've given you.
Rolling with the analogy then, you're the financial institution, bank, hedge fund, whatever, that needs some short-term cash. So you trade your treasuries, your shoes.
If I need to make payroll, I can't make that with treasuries. I make that with cash.
So to the bowling alley we go.
The bowling alley is the financial market.
That is, anybody who's got a bunch of cash to lend overnight.
The bowling shoes are cash or reserves.
Your shoes, the ones you trade in?
My shoes are the collateral, or in this case, the treasuries that I'm putting in.
And also,
the fee I pay to borrow those bowling shoes, that's the repo rate.
Okay, so those are the basics. What happened was that last month, mid-September or so, at this bowling alley that we call the financial markets, there was a rush on bowling shoes. Why? Well, there are a couple of theories. It was getting close to the end of the quarter. Banks had a lot going on. Taxes were due, which meant that too many banks needed cash, bowling shoes, at the same time.
And so suddenly people are paying higher and higher prices to borrow the shoes because they really want to bowl that night.
The repo rate, the fee, remember, that I pay to borrow the shoes, jumped from around 2% at the beginning of September to more than 8% on September 17th. And that is when the New York Fed said, no, 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 we got it.
The Fed is essentially lending bowling shoes in the marketplace.
Andrew Metrick is a professor of finance at the Yale School of Management who, as it happens, studies financial crises. And this, Metrick says, is not that.
What we're seeing happening in repo markets now is very different than what happened in repo markets in 2008 during the financial crisis.
We ran Beth Hammack's bowling shoe analogy past him.
I think it's a good one.
It is, isn't it?
In the financial crisis, basically, all of a sudden, the people who run the bowling alley realized a few things.
First of all, and most importantly,
these shoes that people are giving us as collateral for the bowling shoes are actually really not so good.
In other words, in 2008, people really believed that the fancy shoes that Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers were trading in to get cash for bowling shoes, they weren't worth anything.
And once they started thinking about that, and they realized there's not enough people sitting around who can actually evaluate the creditworthiness of all these people bringing in their shoes and the quality of all the shoes they're giving, they just said, you know what? We're not giving out any bowling shoes right now until we see better collateral.
The repo market ground to a halt, and thus a financial crisis was born. That was 2008, which, again, is not this.
This is really very different than 11 years ago.
In 2008, the quality of the shoes was in question. Now there just aren't enough shoes to go around, which is why the Fed got involved.
There's all kinds of things to be worried about in the economy right now, but this is not one of them.
So there you go. The repo market via a trip to the bowling alley. You can tell me what you'd like explained next at marketplace.org, or you can get me on Twitter at Kai Ryssdal, KAIRYSSDAL. The opioid crisis in this country is playing out in countless ways in thousands of communities in every state. It's a healthcare crisis. It's a crime and punishment crisis. And in West Virginia in particular, it's a foster care crisis, too. The system there is so overwhelmed that state lawmakers voted to privatize it earlier this year, and child advocates are suing the state for failing to protect kids from abuse and neglect. Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has spent more than a year covering opioids, and today, as part of that work, we go inside West Virginia's foster care system. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Roxy Todd has the first of two stories.
Circuit Court Judge Joanna Tabbitt sits at her desk, taking notes in a yellow legal pad as she reviews a stack of about a dozen cases.
Every judge that you talk to in the state of West Virginia will tell you that their dockets are completely filled with abuse neglect cases.
Almost 9 out of every 10 of these cases involve a parent who struggles with addiction. As a judge, Tabbitt decides which children stay in foster care and which ones are reunited with their birth families. She says the ultimate goal is to get the kids back with their parents. But that only happens in about half of all cases.
The time frames are just too tight.
Usually, parents are given about a year to prove they are able to kick their addiction.
And you're not going to be able to get everyone into recovery and to get everyone where they need to be, because most people do relapse. That's just part of the addiction process.
There are about 7,000 kids in foster care today in West Virginia. That's up almost 70% in 6 years. Spending has gone up, too. The state estimates the state and federal government will spend more than $330 million this year on child welfare services. Foster care is part of that.
We recognize we have a child welfare crisis in this state.
Bill Crouch is with the State Department of Health and Human Resources. He says in some emergency situations, a foster home cannot be found.
We have had to take children and keep them in a hotel or motel somewhere close.
Children sometimes stay in a hotel with a social worker or even inside a state office on a cot or a blow-up mattress. The first thing social workers do when a child needs to be removed from their home is to try to find a relative, like a grandparent. But if no relative will take them, they turn to a foster care agency, like the Children's Home Society in Charleston. On a Friday afternoon, the phones are ringing off the hook.
Happy Friday. This is Charlotte.
Charlotte Barnett is a social worker. On this day, Barnett and her staff are often scrambling in a frenzy, trying to find someone who will take a child, even just for the weekend. Every spare inch of their building is filled with piles of donated baby clothes, car seats, and toys. Barnett trains and oversees about 30 foster families in Kanawha County. And when Child Protective Services calls looking for a family, she's the one who picks up the phone day and night.
I'm sure that those workers have been working all day to try to find a home. It's heartbreaking.
On this day, a call comes in that a home is needed immediately for 3 children, siblings.
Right now I have no idea because everybody I have right now is totally full. So
Barnett and the other social workers call every foster family on their list.
We got a slight situation here at the Charleston office, and I need a little help.
By late afternoon on a Friday, a home is finally found for all three kids for one night. Then, the next morning, the social workers enlist a wider search across the state to find a home for the long term. This type of situation is common inside West Virginia's foster care system. These kids then have to deal with the emotional fallout that comes from the chaos. And the job of helping them work through that trauma often falls on the foster parents. In Charleston, West Virginia, I'm Roxy Todd for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Roxy's going to bring us the stories of some of those foster families. You can also check out the Uncertain Hour podcast for more on the opioid crisis. Everything you need at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which all y'all gotta start paying attention, a survey from the Pew Research Center about technology and how it influences life in these United States. 10 questions in all. Everything from, can you identify what two-factor authentication is? Just 28% said yes. To 63% knowing what phishing is, which is good, I suppose. Here's the biggie, though, for my money. Only 29% of Americans know that WhatsApp and Instagram are both owned by Facebook. You gotta pay attention. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 181 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ up 79 points, 1% there. The S&P 500 rose 26 points, 0.9%, 29.19. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Soul to Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Soul to Story are available now.